This is Jeff Blankford. Well, my guest today, Paul Pilar, worked for the CIA for 28 years, during which time he rose to be one of the agency's top analysts, and is the author more recently of Why America Misunderstands the World. His commentaries can be found on the National Interest and Consortium News, where I found two articles that fit neatly together that I plan to discuss with him today. ISIS attack exposes anti-Iran propaganda, and Trump fans the Mideast fires of hate. Welcome, Paul Pilar, to Takes on the World.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
I'm glad to have you here today. While Donald Trump didn't declare war on Iran during his trip last month to Riyadh, it would seem he gave the Saudis license to do whatever it wishes in the region, to the point of supporting its blockading of neighboring Qatar, home to the largest U.S. military base in the Persian Gulf, but also a partner with Iran and ownership of the world's largest natural gas field. What's going on here?
Well, certainly the main theme of Mr. Trump's trip was anti-Iranism, and I would agree that although Trump did not instigate the particular moves against Qatar that were led by the Saudis, there's no question that they were emboldened to do this sort of thing, given that they had just had this visit from the president of the most powerful country in the world, in which he was really going all in with the Saudis, kind of sword dancing his way to what was nothing less than what seemed like unequivocal support. And then, of course, after the Saudis and Emiratis did make their move against Qatar, even though Secretary of State Tillerson has been trying to smooth things over, and so has Secretary Mattis, the main thing that came out of the White House was one or two of these Trumpian tweets that, again, took the Saudi side four square. So, yeah, there's no question that his visit and what he's been saying and doing has had an effect in encouraging the Saudis to do what they've done.
Well, I can imagine, particularly going after Qatar, that this must have members of his cabinet, McMaster, General Mattis, as well as Tillerson, scratching their heads and wondering what Trump is going to do next to undermine what they're doing.
Well, yeah, it's one more example, and a fairly glaring one, of the guy at the top being not constrained, particularly in his statements that he puts out by way of Twitter. And so you get these mixed messages, which are certainly taken note of by foreign governments. I mentioned the efforts by people like Secretary Tillerson to try to smooth things over, because this whole divide within the Gulf Cooperation Council with the Saudi and Emirati moves against Qatar was very much in opposition to another of the themes of the president's visit, which was we have supposedly this very united opposition to this great coalition of evil forces, as it was simplistically described, with Iran being part of it and Sunni terrorists being another part of it, even though they're on opposite sides of the fence. And so there was this theme of a supposedly new Arab NATO, as it was sometimes dubbed in the commentaries, and then, you know, barely a week or so later, you have this enormous fracture in the supposed united front, the supposed Arab NATO, with nothing less than withdrawal of diplomatic relations and an economic blockade against Qatar.
What's astonishing is the other U.S. allies quickly joined in with the Saudis to blockade and to withdraw diplomatic relations with Qatar. What is... I know for years Qatar has been more of a pragmatic competitor for the in the Sunni world with the Saudis, but what triggered this particular action at this time?
Well, we already spoke about the timing being related to Mr. Trump's visit. The issues, the underlying issues, certainly are not mainly the one about Qataris supporting extremists, which they have in terms of funding, but as we know, the Saudis have been doing that at least as much as the Qataris have been. So that was inconsistent and insincere line of criticism.
Probably
the
more.
Underlying issues, the underlying issues have been there for years and years, particularly Qatar's hosting of Al Jazeera when it created that channel with all of its very unrestrained freewheeling journalism raising issues that were very uncomfortable for the other monarchies, particularly the Saudis. So that's been a huge thorn in the side of the rest of the GCC and specifically Saudi Arabia ever since Al Jazeera was created. There has been basically different perspectives taken towards some of the other Arab Spring uprisings elsewhere in the region, in which the Qataris took a more pragmatic view, especially in seeing the Muslim Brotherhood as a basically nonviolent alternative to the more violent forms of radical Islam, but with the likes of the Saudis taking a much different point of view, since the Saudis saw the Brotherhood as a implicit challenge to their own legitimacy, because it represented a very different way of integrating Islam in politics as opposed to the absolute monarchy in Saudi Arabia. And then some of these other states that, as you mentioned, joined in, they had their own reasons, partly being beholden to Saudi Arabia. That's certainly true of the government in Yemen, the one that is in control of basically the eastern part of the country and exists only by virtue of Saudi and Emirati support. And in the case of Egypt and General Sisi, he, of course, has been practicing an increasingly harsher form of authoritarianism in which the Muslim Brotherhood was his main foe, and it was a Muslim Brotherhood president, popularly elected, whom he deposed when he took power. So those are all the reasons, which mostly have to do with questions of internal politics and legitimacy, that those countries took the diplomatic stance that they did.
But with the U.S. having the largest base, its largest base in the Persian Gulf in Qatar, that would seem that the U.S. military and the Pentagon would have state objections even publicly to the Saudi position. Have they done that at all?
Well, it's, of course, they've got the discomfort of having to first reconcile what they're doing with their own president's position. And this is why there was a lot of head-scratching and unease at the State Department and at the Pentagon. And the question was raised as to just how aware Mr. Trump may have been with regard to the U.S. military presence in Qatar and how big it was and how it was, you know, the biggest U.S. airbase in the whole region. I think we still don't know whether he was fully aware of that when he tweeted his support for the Saudi side. So I think the Pentagon's main concern is managing their own president as far as this issue is concerned.
Well, you know, this brings up the main target has been Iran, and I don't think most Americans, most of the listeners, were aware of the partnership between Iran and Qatar of the world's largest natural gas field. I think that is something that the U.S. media doesn't talk about. The isolation of Iran as being the leading sponsor of state terrorism. I pointed out before I called you that this has been a mantra, and reporters never ask the officials or members of Congress who say that to give an example. It's just like a given. And maybe you could explain how this has developed and what the likelihood, what outcome is going to be of it.
Well, you're quite right in using the term mantra. We there's a whole vocabulary here that just gets kind of recited automatically whenever Iran comes up in any discourse in Washington, Republicans and Democrats. Biggest state sponsor of terrorism, nefarious behavior, malign behavior, destabilizing behavior. And then when you get down to specifics, it's hard to get these specifics in terms of exactly what Iran is doing that endangers U.S. interests. Now, with regard to terrorism, if you look at, for example, the official State Department reports on these things and why, you know, Iran, what the justification is for Iran still being on the state sponsor list, it talks mainly about things like its alliance with Lebanese Hezbollah, its support to Hamas, and, And, you know, certainly those, especially with Hezbollah, that kind of relationship is going to continue. In terms of actual terrorist activity, we're really dealing mainly in the past. The last previous time in which we could really put Iranian fingerprints on an act of terrorism, not something that took place in a larger war theater, but things that really meet the official definition of terrorism, which is attack against non-combatants. We really have to go back over 20 years to the Khobar Towers bombing in Saudi Arabia in 1996, in which the investigation did establish that this was Saudi Hezbollah with Lebanese Hezbollah and Iranian support behind it. And that, of course, is when we had a much bigger military presence in the kingdom that was very visible, and that was it. But that's over 20 years ago. A lot of things have happened since then in which our focus has been mainly on the likes of Al-Qaeda and Islamic State or ISIS, all on the radical Sunni side, very much opposed to and different from anything Iran presents. And indeed, as far as ISIS, the main threat du jour, is concerned, the Iranians have been very much opposed to it. They've been quite active, especially in Iraq, with regard to their support, especially to the Iraqi government, and Iraqi militias, and so on, in fighting against ISIS. We've also had previous, albeit brief, before they were closed off by us, periods of cooperation with the Iranians, and I'm thinking specifically the first few months after 9/11, in late 2001 and the first month or so of 2002, after we intervened in Afghanistan, overthrew the Taliban, or ousted them from what was their de facto position of power in most of Afghanistan with a military offensive, and they, of course, had been the host and ally of Al-Qaeda at the time of 9/11. Iranian officials then worked very closely and effectively, and U.S. diplomats who were involved can testify to this, in setting up and supporting the new Afghan government, which we supported for quite a few years, and trying to get a peaceful transition that would ensure we wouldn't have something like Al-Qaeda raising its ugly head again in Afghanistan the way it did prior to 9/11. And that was going well, and the Iranians had hoped that kind of cooperation would continue, but then President George W. Bush, in his State of the Union address in 2002, declared the axis of evil, in which he put Iran in the same bucket as Saddam Hussein's Iraq and North Korea, and it was just a huge slamming of the door in the face of the Iranians. So that's part of the history, and much of what's forgotten, not just the history, but the current lines of conflict and what Iran has been doing vis-a-vis ISIS. The attacks by ISIS in Tehran were a reminder of this. I think the only reason we didn't see attacks like that earlier was because it's been difficult for ISIS to recruit the necessary personnel inside Iran to conduct an operation like that. Well, they finally did do it, and it reportedly was Iranian Kurds from the northwest who were the perpetrators of those terrorist attacks. But it was a big reminder that we forget so much here in Washington when we talk about Iran as the biggest state sponsor of terrorism and so on. They are on the opposite side of the terrorist threat number one right now, which is ISIS.
Well, that brings to mind, it was David Frum, the speechwriter, a Canadian, a neocon, who staged a major coup by writing that speech and inserting the axis of evil into it, which seems to follow Israel's agenda. And even with the, we have adopted, it seems, Israel's enemies. Hezbollah has not threatened the United States. It was accused of the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut, where I happened to be at the time, in 1983. but no proof has ever been made. Then was the Iranians were supposed to have hired Hezbollah to do that. In any case, Hezbollah has not made any threats or launched any attacks, terrorist attacks, against the United States, period. Certainly, there were some kidnappings early in the 80s while Israel was still occupying southern Lebanon. But the United States, would the United States have any real reason for not being an ally with Iran were it not for Israel's opposition?
Well, I would hesitate to use the term ally. I mean, what I would favor is a totally uncommitted balance of power kind of policy, which would work to our advantage, in which we make other countries and groups curry our favor rather than throwing our support unconditionally behind particular states that we've designated as our traditional friends, and we have to stand by them no matter what. We don't have formal alliances of the NATO sort in the Middle East, and I don't think we should. What we should do is take advantage of our ability to do business with everyone, including the Iranians, but also doing business with the Gulf countries and with Israel and everyone else, without being totally beholden to and throwing our lot totally in with any one of them. You are quite right to bring up Israel, because in addition to the Saudis and the Emiratis over in the Gulf, the theme of isolating Iran and not doing any business with Iran, of course, has been a very strong theme of the Netanyahu government in Israel. That theme serves a number of purposes for that government. It takes attention away from things that it does not want to discuss, the occupation, the Palestinian issue, which is not going away. It enables them to point another player, which could be seen as a rival for regional influence to themselves, as the source of all evil in the region, and that's pretty much the way the Israelis consistently describe it, and a huge distraction from those things that they don't want to discuss. So, yes, we are, in effect, to the extent that we follow that theme, we are subcontracting our policy to the Israelis and to the Saudis in particular, as opposed to pursuing what would be in our best interest, which is to do business with everyone.
My guest is Paul Pilar, and as you can guess, we're talking about the situation in the Middle East at the moment. Benjamin Netanyahu, on several occasions, and he's not the only Israeli who's done that, has said that ISIS is not the threat. Iran is a threat, and in fact, Israeli hospitals have treated, apparently, ISIS fighters. They will treat anybody who is fighting the regime in Syria, and at one point even an ISIS unit attacked some Israeli soldiers and apologized afterward. So it's very strange that what ISIS picks as its targets, Israel doesn't seem to be one of them.
Well, this is just an extension of the be consistently anti-Iran on everything theme that has been dominant policy of the Netanyahu government. So you apply that theme to Syria, and that results in a policy in which anybody who is on the opposite side of the Syrian civil war, and as we know, the Iranians, along with the Russians, have been supporting the Assad regime, and ISIS has been one of a number of armed groups that have been not supporting the regime but have been fighting against it, as well as fighting among themselves, of course. Well, that implies, from the Israeli government's perspective, anyone who's an enemy of the one that we want to consistently see as the big enemy in the Middle East, namely Iran, is someone we're willing to work with, hence the things like the medical assistance that you mentioned, which, if you really looked at it more objectively in terms of terrorism versus counterterrorism, extremism and violence versus moderation and peaceful inclinations, makes no sense whatsoever. But if you've subordinated everything to demonizing Iran, then that's the kind of policy that follows.
Well, you can't talk usually about the Middle East in this country without talking about the role of the oil companies. And it seems that the American oil companies would have been very willing to deal with Saddam Hussein, except they weren't allowed to, as the American oil companies would be very willing to have dealt all these years with Iran. Matter of fact, Conoco had to cancel one of its contracts. They were the last country to do that, company to do that, because of the sanctions against Iran. So it would seem there's some other motivations, there's some other forces that are pushing the anti-Iran line, and the oil companies are not part of that. How do you see the role of oil companies in the Middle East?
No, I agree. The oil companies really aren't part of that, and I expect for Secretary Tillerson, you know, former CEO of ExxonMobil that he is, he had even additional reasons to instinctively cringe at some of the ways that President Trump has been approaching this, where it's a matter of encouraging hostility and toward Iran and division in the Gulf, as opposed to encouraging, which is what President Obama tried to do, at least rhetorically, and then, of course, acted on it insofar as he pushed the nuclear agreement with Iran, to have more of a rapprochement. And as he once put it near the end of his term of office, different countries in the neighborhood have to learn to live together. Well, the oil companies have an interest in no war in the Gulf, in peaceful commerce, in doing business with all of the countries that have petroleum resources. So no, that's not where the Iran anti-Iran theme is coming from. It really is coming from the places we identified before and their impact, especially with regard to Israel, on domestic U.S. politics.
Now, what connection, if any, could you make with the situation vis-a-vis Russia at the moment? Because we have, I know National Association of Manufacturers, has lobbied against sanctions to Russia, and I believe they also lobbied against sanctions against Iran. But it seems that the corporate world doesn't have that kind of clout when it comes to our foreign policy toward either Russia or Iran. How do you see it from there?
Well, it's the hard and fast interests of the corporate world here in Washington, despite the resources we tend to associate with the corporate world, tend to get overwhelmed in many cases by a very simplistic way of looking at the outside world that unfortunately many Americans share, and play into some of those other outside forces that we discussed, you know, the Israeli and Saudi type influence, that sees everything in very black and white terms, good versus evil, you know, exactly the kinds of themes that Mr. Trump was articulating during his visit. And you're quite right. This goes against U.S. interests, not only of the sort of diplomatic and security interests that I tend to focus on, but the hard economic interests that U.S. businesses would be most interested in. We talked about the oil companies a moment ago, but it also is true with many other companies, such as would be represented by the National Association of Manufacturers, that are looking at export markets that get closed to them when there are sanctions or embargoes put in place. You mentioned Russia, you mentioned Iran. Cuba is another example. It's going to be interesting to see how that issue plays out. The congressional embargo, as you know, is still in effect. But now we hear the administration making noises about walking back some of the opening up of transportation and so on that was done under the previous administration. We'll see how that works. But those are all places where you have certain intensely expressed views, whether it's especially by the Israeli-connected lobby in the case of Iran. Cuba, we know we've had a strong Cuban hardcore lobby that has been in favor of maintaining the embargo and isolation. Russia is a little more complicated, but yes, these are often and usually are situations in which the hardcore line that involves sanctions and isolation goes directly against some important U.S. economic interests, including companies that are losing export markets.
Well, this the push against Iran has been going on for some time now, and Iran, anything Iran does seems to be criticized within Washington, that no member of Congress can even dare say a word that might be considered to be favorable to Iran. That you have a member of Democrats challenging Obama, Robert Menendez from New Jersey, who happens to be Cuban as well, trying to actually, before the Iran deal came through, trying to get Democrats to sign a resolution attacking it. And this is working until Dianne Feinstein from here in California made a speech on the floor of the Senate, maybe her finest hour, in which she said if this resolution goes through, it's essentially a declaration of war on Iran, and that stopped the rush of Democrats to sign this resolution. But other than that, there just seems to be very little opposition in either house in Congress to say, wait a minute, Iran is not the ogre that we make it out to be. In fact, the Saudis are. Yesterday there was, which I reported earlier, an attempt to block part of an arms deal to the Saudis by the Democrats, which lost. And you had people like McCain and Corker and McConnell justifying sending precision weapons to the Saudis so they wouldn't kill as many civilians. It's just like Saturday Night Live or Jon Stewart, The Daily Show. You can't believe these statements, particularly when Yemen, which is being bombed by the Saudis, is in the midst of a horrible cholera epidemic. They don't even pay any attention to that.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'd like to underscore what you said about your senior senator, Senator Feinstein, with whom I've had the pleasure of meeting on this very issue more than once. And she has been a very strong and constructive force for sensible policy toward Iran, so I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I think part of what we're seeing here, in addition to the influence of certain intensely held views expressed by certain influential lobbies on these various issues.
Like AIPAC.
Well, exactly. But then there are those other ones we discussed with regard to Cuba and so on. I think we're seeing also a broader phenomenon where we Americans sort of psychologically and politically need a foe. You know, that's very simple to think of, not some coalition or something, but some one bad force. Well, throughout the Cold War, we had that. You know, it was the Soviet Union. It was Moscow. And ever since the end of the Cold War, we've kind of been stumbling around as to who the arch foe is. Well, now, you know, we're getting a little more focused on North Korea. Maybe that will take some attention away. But I think Iran has, because it suited these other more parochial purposes, has for most of the last decade or so filled that role. And so then you get that automatic vocabulary, the mantras you referred to before, the unthinking reference. And you're quite right. It is a political hazard for a member of Congress to say anything that sounds like being soft on Iran or not recognizing the threat from Iran, even though the vocabulary is so general it doesn't ever get into the, or very rarely gets into the specifics to explain exactly why we should be having those policies made that way.
Well, actually, Feinstein was in a very solid position financially in terms of supporting California. I guess she was able to, maybe the only one who could actually stand on the floor and had the respect of the Senate and someone AIPAC would not dare go after when she made that speech. I talked about it on my program, but I didn't see any other reporting about it in the mainstream media.
Well, at least there were was influence behind the scenes with other members and so on. We might note in terms of current issue, there's new legislation sponsored by Senator Corker and Senator Cardin, who are the senior Republican and Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, for new sanctions against Iran, and like similar legislation in the past. There's an automatic tilt toward people favoring sanctions on Iran as a statement that they can show that they are anti-Iran, which is politically required, without thinking through exactly what the sanctions might do. And part of the problem with this legislation, I think it's S-722, if I remember the exact citation of the bill, is in the name of other things, you know, ballistic missiles or this so-called nefarious regional activity, the bill in its most recent form would tie any future president's hands in carrying out our obligations under the nuclear agreement that would be our obligations if Iran continues to carry out its obligations with regard to its nuclear program. In short, it would be a violation of the nuclear accord. Now, some people defending it are trying to find ways of saying, well, it wouldn't really be a direct violation. Actually, there are some very troublesome clauses in there. But this is one more example of the specifics being overridden by this general urge to make an anti-Iranian statement and to stay on the safe political side in doing so.
We're getting down to the end of the hour. What do you foresee, given the erratic behavior of Trump, but the general anti-Iran policy of both houses of Congress, what do you foresee in the coming year vis-a-vis Iran?
Well, the main hope is that Iran will continue, as it has so far, to observe its very stringent obligations under the nuclear agreement in terms of what it does in form of uranium enrichment, as well as being subject to highly intrusive international inspections. And as every month goes by, it becomes harder and harder for those who want to do things like throw still more sanctions on Iran at the risk of violating the nuclear agreement to defend that, because you'd also have to be defending the proposition that, well, we should trash this agreement, even though it is succeeding in closing all routes to an Iranian nuclear weapon. And wasn't that what we were all supposedly supposed to be worried about up and before a couple of years ago? So I do have that bit of optimism that the nuclear agreement itself is going to be a break on these tendencies. But I don't see the tendencies going away anytime soon. And with regard to Mr. Trump and his unpredictability, I think on this particular issue, his inclination will be to fall back on the same themes we saw on his recent Persian Gulf trip, and anti-Iranism will continue to be one of the main themes.
Well, Paul Pilar, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Takes on the World and shedding some light on a very important and complicated situation. And I'll look forward to speaking with you again.
Okay, my pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.